My name is Rabbi Reuven Mann, I'll be doing the Shnayim Mikra project for Parshas Beshalach. I am the Menahel at Yeshiva B'nai Torah, which is a post-high school yeshiva located in Far Rockaway. The Rosh Yeshiva is Rav Yisrael Chait. And anyone interested in the hearing the Shiurim, many, many shiurim that are given, they're all put up on the web. It's ybt.org. And I've just been appointed as the rabbi of the Unusual of Phoenix, which I'll be beginning in about a week or two. So we're going to begin with the first Aliyah. This is chapter Yud Gimel, that's 13. And it begins with a verse Yud Zayin, that's 17. It seems to me that Beshalach represents a new phase in the story of the Exodus. The Exodus, of course, was only the first step in the formation of the Jewish people. This is a new entity that's coming into being. It hasn't actually come into being yet. This is the first step was, of course, the removal from the enslavement, and beyond that, it wasn't merely to end the enslavement, but for the Jews to leave and to assume a status of becoming a nation, a very, obviously a very, very unique nation. And it seems to me that at this point, the focus now shifts. In the previous parshiot, beginning with the enslavement of the Jews, the advent of Moshe, and Moshe's confrontation with Paro, the Jewish people, it seems to me, are pretty much passive, pretty much in the background. They're not actively involved. It seems that they came to terms with their fate. You see the extent to which the only time we do see the Jews being active, it seems, is in their resistance to Moshe, when things take a turn for the worse. But they're not involved, really, in resistance, in standing up against Paro. And the main figures, of course, are Moshe Rabbeinu and his confrontation with Paro. That's the entire focus. We don't get any real look at the Jewish people themselves. In the previous parashiyot, Moshe Rabbeinu was sent by Hashem, and the confrontations with Paro, tries to persuade Paro. First he tries to persuade him with reason, and then with demonstrations, and finally with signs and plagues. And eventually all of that comes to naught. And at the conclusion of the plague of darkness, Paro gets angry and tells Moshe not to see him again. Moshe leaves with anger, and that sets the stage for the slaying of the firstborn. And that really brings Paro to his knees. And then the Jews he sends the Jews forth. Parshas Beshalach really introduces us to the development of the Jewish people. The first challenge, of course, they faced was the trek in the wilderness. As we know, the objective was for the Jews to receive the Torah, to build the Mishkan, the tabernacle, and after that they would enter the land. As we know, of course, it didn't happen that way, because there's free will, and a lot has to do with how the Jews are going to behave. And there were many, many travails in the wilderness. So Parshas Beshalach really is introducing us to the Jewish people, how they conducted themselves, what takes place with the trek in the wilderness. I want to just basically review the narrative, the basic ideas of the narrative, and then perhaps we'll analyze a certain important ideas. The most significant idea, will break down the first Aliyah into two phases. First of all, from verse 17 through 22. It makes the point that God did not lead them on the straight path, which would have been the by the land of the Plishtim, of the Philistines, would have been along the coast. that would have been the most efficient way to travel from Egypt into Canaan. And the pasuk gives you the reason, because God was quote-unquote concerned that they might encounter war, and that if they were to do so, that's giving you an insight into the state of the Jewish people at that time, that they would have been fearful and they would have wanted to return to Egypt. As we see, in spite of everything, that theme, when things became difficult for the Jews numerous times in the wilderness, they did have this idea: let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt. So God set it up in a way that they wouldn't encounter the Plishtim. So it says that God led them in a roundabout path. It's interesting, you see that, of course, one could ask that God could have seen to it that there would not have been a war, that the Philistines would not have come out to attack them. But it's a fundamental principle that God relates to us through the situation that he's created. We're expected to operate within the framework of the laws of nature. So that God knew that the Jews weren't prepared at that time to encounter that type of a phenomenon. So therefore God had them go in a different way. It also makes the following points that v'chamushim olu b'nei Yisrael me'aretz Mitzrayim. That's in verse 18, that the Jews, when they left Egypt, they left with arms, with armaments. That's telling you a very, very important point, and that is that they assumed the status of being a nation, and the part of the responsibility of a nation is to defend itself. And the Jews thus had the capability, at least the arms, to defend themselves. As we will see, even in this parsha, they already engaged in warfare. Now, Judaism is not a religion of pacifism. We don't extol the conduct of war, but self-defense is a basic responsibility. Then it tells us that that Moshe, it mentions specifically that Moshe had taken the Atzmos Yosef, the bones of Yosef. This is very, very important, because Yosef, when he died, he realized that it would not be possible to gain permission for him to be removed and buried in Canaan as his father Yaakov was. So he caused the Jews to take an oath. He caused his brothers, and the brothers themselves couldn't fulfill the oath. And this oath was transmitted from generation to generation. It's a very, very important point that the time came, the oath was transmitted, and it was obligatory upon the Jews to fulfill this oath and to remove Yosef. And according to the rabbis, it wasn't just Yosef, but all of the leaders of the tribes, their bodies were disinterred, and they were taken to be buried in the land of Israel. Then it tells us that that God led them. At this point in time, the trek in the wilderness is very, very interesting, because God is still the element, the level of divine providence in God's relationship to them is much greater, so to speak, in terms of the day-to-day activities. Eventually, when they would come into the land, they would assume a certain level of independence. Of course, God is with them, and the extent of divine providence is always dependent upon the level, the spiritual level of the Jews. But the actual day-to-day activities in the wilderness was dictated by God led them, so that the journeyings were not of their own choosing. They didn't choose where to go and when to go, but everything was determined for them by the system of the clouds, the pillars, the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night, to light up the path for them and to direct them. Which meant that they had to be prepared to travel by day or by night. That's verse 22. That he didn't remove the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. And the previous pasuk ends, Lo lechash yomam v'layla, that they could go by day and by night, whenever the summons would come forth. Now, part two of the first Aliyah is chapter 14, from verse 1 up to verse 9. And this is very, very fascinating, because then, having established the fact that their travels would be according to the dictates of Hashem, now Hashem tells Moshe to command the Jews to go backward and to encamp before this place called Pi HaChirot, and the Chumash describes the place between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal Tzafon. That's very, very interesting, because Baal Tzafon, according to the rabbis, was a Egyptian idol. And the Torah makes it clear that God wreaked vengeance against the idols of Egypt, not just on the night of the firstborn. It was not just the firstborn, but all the gods of Egypt, God executed judgments. It means to say that God destroyed them. But this one remained standing. And according to the rabbis, it was the purpose was part of the plan over here. There's a whole plan to ensnare Paro, to encourage Paro to leave Egypt and to come chasing after the Jews. That's what the second part of the first Aliyah deals with, that God is setting up a trap to ensnare Paro to leave Egypt and to come chasing after the Jews. That's what the verses say, that there's when the Jews go backward towards Egypt, Paro will have the impression that they're lost and that they've been closed in by the wilderness. Then God says that he'll strengthen the heart of Paro. He'll give him that extra bit of courage that's needed to chase after them. And I'll become glorified through Paro and all of his army. And all of Egypt will know that I am the Lord. And the Torah tells us that the Jews did that. And Rashi says that's praiseworthy. That's telling you the praises of the Jews, that of course you'd think that emotionally they'd be afraid to do that. Their natural impulse would be to go further and further away from Egypt. But at this point in time, they had the strength to follow the dictates of Moshe. Then it goes on to tell us that it was told to Paro. Rashi says that he had sent along spies, that the nation had ran away, and that the Paro had a change of heart. Him and his servants. It's an interesting phenomenon. It's hard for us to relate to that. After all the devastation that they went through, just reading about the plagues, it's hard for us to imagine how any rational person would resist, would refuse, just for purely for self-interest, reasons of self-interest, and how we can learn from this how significant it is that a irrational leader whose ego completely takes hold of him brings down ruin upon himself and upon his nation. We've seen this phenomenon throughout history. Most recently, well, you see it every day, but in the case of World War II, insanity, the case of Hitler, in spite of all the indications that everything was falling apart, he could not ever bring himself to recognize. That's what the rabbis say, that the Rishayim, that the wicked people, even on the doorway of Gehenna, they can't do tshuva. Indeed, that's the tragedy of Paro, that he couldn't do tshuva. So they have a change of heart. And what did we do? Why did we send the Jews away from serving us? Then it says that he harnessed his chariot, and he took his nation with him. He was so involved in this, according to Rashi, that he did it himself. He personally harnessed the chariot. And then he took the 600 choice chariots and all of the chariots of Egypt with officers. And it concludes by telling us again that God hardened his heart. And he chased after the B'nai Yisrael, after the Jewish people. And then it tells us that the Jewish people left with a high hand. And Rashi explains that to mean bigvura gavoha, with a great sense of strength and publicly. That is, they didn't, in fact, Paro wanted them to leave at night, at the actual time of the slaying of the firstborn, But Moshe responded that they're going to leave on the next day. They're not going to leave like thieves in the night. So they went out and with a formation, with a certain national, a certain sense of strength and confidence. I would like to, before moving on to the second Aliyah, I would like to deal with one issue that emerges when you study B'Shalach. And it would appear, superficially anyways, that the Jews perhaps did not keep their word. That's a question that's raised by the commentators. Because when you go back to chapter 3, Moshe is instructed by Hashem at the burning bush to make the request of Paro. The request that was made was basically a very modest one. And one wonders why Paro was so stubborn. The Jews never requested their freedom. They only requested the opportunity to leave Egypt and to serve Hashem. That is, they said clearly that the message was that God had called upon us and they wanted to go a distance of 3 days in the wilderness in order to serve Hashem. So the implication was that that's all they were asking for, and that once that was done, they would return. However, we see that here the Jews left, and there was absolutely no intention of returning. And the Paro sent along spies, and then he saw that the nation had ran away. And if so, the question arises, was it correct? Why would God act in such a way? Why would God, of course, has the power to demand that Paro release the Jews completely? So why is it that... at least superficially, the request was for an opportunity to serve God. Implication is that we'll return, even though they may not have said that outright. And yet, in point of fact, they had no intention of returning. Is that deception? That's the question. Now, many commentators take it up. And of course, one can defend it. Even if you say that there was deception, one can defend it, because a person has the right. Since what Paro was doing was sheer evil, he had no right to enslave the Jews. Not to mention the fact that the Jews had been benefactors, but even if they weren't benefactors, nobody has the... That's a very serious crime. In fact, there is the idea of kidnapping or enslaving another individual against his will is a very serious crime. So all of the affliction that Paro had brought down upon the Jews, if a person is unjustly imprisoned, or can imagine in the concentration camps, and the only way he can escape is by using deception, of course, he's supposed to use deception. He doesn't owe the other person the truth in a situation like that. So one can get out of it that way. However, I think that there's a different possibility over here. I'd like to suggest my own answer. Rabbi Soloveitchik, I believe, raised the question that it's strange that the Jews made such a modest request. If Paro was rational, and he was gaining so much from all of this slave labor, one wonders, so why wouldn't he let them go? Let them go and let them serve God, and assuming they'll come back. And they'll continue to work for you. So the question is, why Hashem tell Moshe to make such a modest request? Let's say Paro would have agreed. If Paro would have agreed, so then it would seem the Jews were obliged to follow through and then to come back, and they still would have been slaves. What would have been gained by that? I'd like to suggest that the objective, a major objective, as we will see, of Moshe's encounter with Paro, it was not merely negotiating for the freedom of the Jews, but from the very outset, it was incumbent upon Paro to recognize the truth, to recognize the creator of the universe, and to submit himself to the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this was the battle indeed, because at first Paro rejects it. Who is God that I should listen unto him? And also the Jews I will not send out. But the ongoing debate, the purpose was to demonstrate to the Egyptians that Egypt shall know that I am Hashem. And because of this, Taru was given a task, and that task was to recognize God, not just to let the Jews go, but to let the Jews go because you've recognized the truth. And once you recognize the truth that God is the sovereign, the creator of the universe, and all of your idols are false, and man must submit to his will. So Paro was given something, a mitzvah, so to speak, that wasn't that complicated to do. And the idea was that had Paro been able to absorb this point, had he come to a genuine recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and had he fulfilled the mitzvah, then he would have been transformed completely. So that was really plan A, that Paro should recognize the creator of the universe and submit to his will. And indeed, that was the purpose of all of the so-called plagues. As you see, the purpose of the plagues was not to hurt, was not to inflict pain. That wasn't, even though they did. But the point was, as a result of that, they should ponder, they should think, they should come to a recognition. And you see at certain points along the way, the servants of Paro, even Paro himself, becomes humble. God is the righteous one, and I am wrong. But he's not able to make that complete transformation. At the last moment, his ego takes over. However, in my opinion, all of that comes to an end with the plague of the darkness. At that point, Paro is willing to give in, but he has conditions. He can't submit to God in an unconditional manner. And then he gets angry, and then he tells Moshe, that's it. The negotiations are over. So that ends that phase of the relationship. What happens next is something else. That is the Makas Bechoros, the slaying of the firstborn. It's interesting. Paro did give in at that point. But did Paro give in at the Makas Bechoros, the slaying of the firstborn, because it was his free will, because he recognized the truth? It had nothing to do with free will. It meant that this was the only time that God did not harden his heart. God did not give him the emotional strength to withstand. That was a night of terror, a night of such pain and such terror that the Egyptians had never ever experienced. Paro simply had no choice. He couldn't bear the pain, he couldn't tolerate it. So he drove them out of the land. But that was not a free-willed decision. I think the Pasuk makes that very, very clear. That's in chapter 11, verse 1, when God tells Moshe about the plague of the killing of the firstborn. I'll bring one further plague on Paro and on Egypt, and afterwards he will send you out from here, and when he sends you out from here, it'll be complete. Goresh yegoresh eschem mizeh. He will completely drive you out of here. And the term goresh, that's the term that's used for divorce, which means to say that at that, all the bets were off. All this was not part of the condition, of the original condition. The original condition was that we'll only go for a distance of 3 days. That's true. That would have been the case had Paro accepted Hashem, had he made a free will decision. But that's not the case. He rejected it, and after 9 plagues, after all those opportunities, that phase was over. No further opportunities. Now Paro was treated in a different way. And he was confronted with a blow which he could not withstand, and under the pressure of that blow, he drove the Jews out completely. And there were no strings attached. So the Jews were completely free, and they were under no obligation to return. That's my opinion on how this question can be answered. Indeed, when you take a look at our parsha, B'Shalach, if you read the words of the psukim carefully, you see that it uses the word Vayehapech Levav Paro, V'Yavod Avelav, that Paro and his servants had a change of heart. What was the change of heart? The change of heart was that under the pressure of the blow, of the last blow, they let them go. That's it. We don't want to see you anymore. Of course, after the pain was gone, they reverted back to their old ways, and they had regret. And to me, that indicates that when Paro sent them out, he didn't want to see them again. He didn't want anything to do with them anymore. But that's the way of the Rasha, that he operates purely according to his emotions. And the overwhelming emotion of his own egotism, he couldn't stand to be defeated. And then God strengthened his heart again, and God gave him the requisite courage, and he saw certain signs that the Jews were lost and so on and so forth, and he wanted to believe his own rationalizations, his own emotions. Then he chased after the Jews. But the Jews themselves, in my opinion, did not engage in deception, in leaving permanently.